Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and a very special Boxing Day welcome to the Christmas edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, as part of Faith Explored this Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio. And I'll be introducing a whole panel of guests joining me for today's what is going to be a bit different to the normal Unbelievable debate show. So they'll be joining me in a moment's time. But if you can continue to listen throughout the rest of the day, loads more great Christmas programming coming for you. Between 4 and 5, Christmas from Swansea, an uplifting service from Mount Pleasant Baptist Church in Swansea. There's the traditional carol service from Methodist Central Hall, Westminster at 5. And right through into the evening, you've got carols from Shropshire, Christmas Unsigned with Loretta, and even an international Christmas at 10 o'clock this evening from the Academy in Walthamstow. But let me tell you right now what's coming up on Unbelievable today. Well, a very Merry Christmas to you and welcome along to the Unbelievable Christmas Special, in which we're going to be covering a whole host of topics on today's special Boxing Day programme. We're going to be talking about the truth behind the Star of Bethlehem. We're going to be meeting the atheist who loves Christmas carol services. We're going to be asking whether we should perpetuate the Santa Claus story and much more besides. And I've got a whole bevy of guests joining me on today's programme, very different to the usual format of Unbelievable. And we're going to be having some fun, I'm sure, on today's show. So welcome along to what promises to be a really interesting conversation between my guests. Firstly, Colin Nicol is joining us. He's the author of The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem. He'll be sharing a bit about the book and his theory, which he believes is backed up by scripture and science, that the star that guided the Magi to the infant Jesus was, in fact, a comet. Well, you might have guessed that from the title of the book, but he'll be explaining why. Ruth Jackson is the deputy editor of Premier Youth Work and Children's Work magazines and also heads up Premier's Youth Apologetics. So she's new to the show. She's going to be telling us about what she does and we're going to be talking about some stuff around that. Phil Vischer joins us as well. He's well known as the creator of VeggieTales, the animated films and cartoons, and more recently Buck Denver and the What's in the Bible series. And he hosts the weekly Phil Vischer podcast. He's a friend of the show. We've appeared on each other's podcasts in various ways out in the USA, and he's going to be joining us as well, so we'll have some American input. And Nick Pandolfi was on the show years ago, actually. If you go way back in the back catalogue, you'll find him there. But he's a radio presenter and, if you like, our honorary sceptic for today's programme. This time, we thought it'd be interesting to have Nick explain why he loves Christmas, carol services and the Nativity story, even though he doesn't actually believe in it. And I'm sure that will generate plenty of interesting conversation too. So welcome along, everyone, to today's programme.
Hello.
Hello, Merry Christmas.
Happy Boxing Day.
Indeed. Let's introduce you one at a time as we go around. Very briefly, Colin, welcome along. You're a native in Northern Ireland, aren't you?
That's right. I grew up in Northern Ireland. I have been to America a few times. I got some of my theological education in the States, around Chicago, and then went to Cambridge for my PhD, and then taught at Gordon Conwell over in Boston for a few years. So now I'm back. In Northern Ireland.
I see. Well, we're going to be finding out about the book in the course of today's program. What does a typical Christmas consist of for you, though? Would you say, Colin?
Well, we do with our kids the usual chocolate and Lego kind of advent calendar tradition leading up to Christmas, and integrate Christmas activities and readings about various Christmas stories and what have you in the past. We take the kids to a live nativity sponsored by a local church. We obviously go to the school and church carol services. And then on Christmas Eve, we tend to do a kind of candle-lit little thing within the family with hot chocolate and carol singing carols and reading one of the biblical accounts of the nativity, and then let the kids open a small present as a little taster.
Oh, okay.
And then on Christmas Day, we have we give them a little present at the foot of the bed to make sure that we can sleep in just a little bit, and then we go downstairs and have a little another right. reading of the biblical text, and then let the kids and everyone open presents at that point.
A very in a sense, you keep the Christmas story right at the heart of all the celebrations. Then it sounds like.
Yeah, well, we seek to keep it a meaningful event. I mean, obviously, presents is such a key part in terms of the excitement of the kids and all that. But we want to make sure that Christmas, we remember what Christmas is all about. Of course, Boxing Day is in Northern Ireland for my family has always been a very special day. In many ways, growing up, that was always my favorite day. That was when we had the family members of the family circle around and had the big meal and a lot of games and fun and chat and even some more presents. So no, Boxing Day was always very special.
I'm looking forward to talking to you about this new book, because it sounds like you've come up with something different to all the other theories I've heard so far about the Star of Bethlehem, and we'll be interested to see what the other guests on the show today make of it. Ruth, welcome along. You're in studio with me today.
Hiya.
And you're a relatively recent acquisition here at Premier Towers, yep. aren't you? Do you want to briefly tell us what you do here and what your role is going to involve as well in the future?
Sure. So I started sort of towards the end of October, and I'm the deputy editor of Premier Youthwork magazine and Premier Children's Work. He said Christianity, that's your job. Children's Work magazine.
She's after me job already.
And I've also sort of been brought on board to boost the youth apologetics, which currently isn't you know, it's not really a thing. So no. We're going to be kind of working towards what that's going to look like. And hopefully offering some apologetics material for both youth workers and young people themselves, which is exciting.
Fantastic. Yeah, that sounds good. What does a typical Christmas look like for you though, Ruth?
So my dad was a Church of England vicar, so church was a huge part of Christmas for us. And so we would go to church. I'd often preach just because my dad was always up for like a young person doing it, and I was generally the only person under about 50 in my dad's church, so I sort of represented everyone from 0 to 50. And then
how young were you when you started preaching in church then?
Well, it's more the way I started preaching is appalling. I basically just ripped my dad's sermons to pieces to the point where he got so annoyed he just went, right, fine, you do it. And I went, fine, I will. And my first ever sermon, my dad kept his microphone on and heckled from the back, so it was a terrible experience. I probably was about maybe 17 when I first started speaking in my dad's church. But so Christmas was very much about church, and then we'd always invite people who didn't have anywhere to go for Christmas back to ours, ours or the church. To kind of, my dad used to be a chef, so we'd put on a big meal, and it was really nice because it, like, for us, Christmas was never just about the family. It was about kind of opening our house to everyone who didn't have anywhere to go, and then it would get to sort of the evening, and then we'd begin to open our presents and kind of have a bit more of a family Christmas. But it was very much a big open the house and let everyone in sort of
affair. That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. And given that I know how, from personal experience, how busy church ministers are over the Christmas period, it's amazing that you also opened your house on Christmas Day itself to whoever wanted to.
I don't think we always loved it, to be honest. So I've got a twin sister and a little sister, and my little sister's birthday is 2 days before Christmas, I think she in particular would be like, this is my time.
Bless her. Well, it's also great to have joining us Phil Vischer. Phil, I've long been a fan of the Phil Vischer podcast, and I know that Unbelievable gets the odd mention on your programme too. So it's a bit of a mutual love-in having you on the programme today. But firstly, maybe tell us a little bit about the podcast and about what you do for those who aren't aware of the cultural phenomenon that is VeggieTales. And then I'll ask you about Christmas.
I launched VeggieTales in 1993. 23. I was like 25 years old at the time, 26, something like that. Did that for about 10 years and did it so well that it collapsed into bankruptcy in 2003. And that ended my time. Still voices of about half of the vegetables in VeggieTales, which is one of the ways I pay the bills. But then launched into some new things. What's in the Bible with Buck Denver, working on biblical literacy for kids, some basic apologetics for kids, you know, trying to work them into a more entertaining format of visual media. And also then launched a podcast to talk about current events and all the crazy stuff going on. And, you know, you guys are ahead of us on this, but trying to find your feet in an increasingly post-Christian culture is fairly new for us, especially in middle America. You know, I'm in Chicago, was born and raised in Iowa. So Christianity was just still assumed, you know, even in the 1970s and in the middle of America, even while it was no longer assumed on the coasts. But now more and more, it's less and less assumed even in the middle of America. And that's left a lot of people kind of confused and scrambling for responses, political, social, you know, we're angry, we're confused. and I actually love pointing out your podcast just because you wrestle with such really deep issues more bravely than I ever could. I would just have panic attacks for some of the conversations that you guys have. So it's been fun to point people towards you.
We'll be wrestling with the deep issue of Santa Claus today, obviously, among others. But
that can get people angry
over
absolutely.
Here. Absolutely. I'm expecting the letters to flood in on this side of the pond. Bearing in mind, actually, it's worth pointing out at this point, if you do have younger children in the room, if you're listening to this on Boxing Day on Premier Christian Radio, and there are certain aspects of the Santa Claus thing that you wouldn't want to be revealed to your children, and then you may want to deposit them in a different part of the house for a little while. That's just my very roundabout way of saying, look out, we're going to be, you know, talking about this frankly on today's program.
There are spoilers coming.
Spoilers coming that I wouldn't want to spoil Christmas for any child out there. Phil, briefly, what do you do at Christmas? What's the Phil Vischer household way of doing Christmas?
Yeah, well, all three of my kids are now, two are in college and one is married and off on her own. So things have gotten a bit quieter. We try to have everybody back home. When I was a kid, it was a really big deal because my dad was just insane about buying presents. He loves to give gifts. So it was so much fun, you know, to wake up on Christmas morning when I was a kid. That kind of changed when I was 9 or 10 because my dad left and my parents divorced. And then my mom kind of slipped, you know, pretty near the poverty level for a few years. And so Christmas has since then been a bit melancholy for me personally because there's those early memories where everyone was together and it was so much fun and it was so much to look forward to. And then it kind of blew up when I was about 9 years old, you know, and then it was dad's over here and mom's over there and we don't have much money for presents this year. And so for me, a lot of the joy in my own Christmas today was with my own kids. Just being there,
sure.
You know, just saying, you know, I am here. We are together. We're going to do a tree together as a family. So it was really, and I think this is true for a lot of kids from broken families. It's finding the joy in trying to restore a family celebration, you know, out of a generation that has been so horribly broken with divorce and abandonment.
Yeah. Well, thanks for bringing it down there.
Thank you. So now let's talk about Santa Claus.
No, seriously. Great to hear that commentary. And I'm glad that Christmas has been redeemed at some level in being able to do it in a way that is helpful for you now. Finally, Nick Pandolfi joins us. Nick, welcome along to the program today.
Well, thank you for having me back.
It's great to have you on. You're joining us by the wonders of modern technology on a radio line from another part of the country. You're a radio presenter yourself, and that's why we're able to do that. Very briefly, Nick, tell us what your day job is and also tell us how you tend to celebrate Christmas.
day job is part of a radio team at a radio station on the coast in the UK.
You can say the name. It's all right. I will allow you to mention another radio station on this one. If you want.
The Beach, which is a radio station based at the most easterly point in Britain. And it's a beautiful part of the country, Norfolk and Suffolk. And that's where I grew up. And that's what I do. I'm also a voiceover artist. So I understand where Phil is when once I was asked to be the voice of a squeaky tomato. And and I was asked, I had to ask the question, well, what does a squeaky tomato sound like? They said, give it a go. And they said, that's it. That's a squeaky tomato.
Phil, that is just begging for you to do the Bob the Tomato voice. So
Hi, kids. I'm a non-squeaky tomato. I am an evangelizing tomato, which is a very different thing.
There you are.
Can we get the squeaky tomato from you, Nick, or is that lost in the mists of time?
He's booked on another job.
Okay. Fair enough. I thought it'd be fun to have you on, Nick, because you were a great sport last time, many years ago, that you came on the show to talk about life as what you described then as a proxy atheist. Where do you stand currently on the whole belief spectrum? Are you kind of, nope, there's definitely no God, or are you sort of, maybe, not sure? Where would, if you had to put a label on it?
Well, the good Christmas cracker joke response would be that I'm an atheist unless I'm very, very ill, in which case it's open to debate. But in truth, when I spoke to you last, I said that I was agnostic, and that's really, that uncomfortable fence is where I'm still sitting.
Okay.
I haven't jumped either way. I'm still an agnostic. I don't want to be labelled one of those angry atheists who seem to sit in a corner sometimes and get very grumpy when people start talking about being happy at Christmas because there's no such thing. I'm not one of those.
All right. Well, look, I will come back to you later for your Christmas because that's kind of what we're going to be talking to you about anyway. So hang on there and we'll come to you. Before we do that, just a reminder that today is the Unbelievable Christmas Special. Not our usual format for the programme, but we're going to be examining a few different things, the truth behind the Star of Bethlehem. We're going to be talking to Nick, the atheist who still loves Christmas and Christmas carol service and things. We're going to be talking about Santa Claus and other stuff as well. My guests Colin Nicol, Ruth Jackson, Phil Vischer and Nick Pandolfi join me for today's special show. Right, well, we're in a Christmassy spirit, and what could be more Christmassy than talking about the Star of Bethlehem? And I'd like to give you a chance now to tell us a little bit about this book that you've recently brought out, Colin, The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem. Of course, in fact, as I understand it, Colin, the story of the Magi and the star, it wouldn't necessarily have all happened under the same roof that the shepherds and everyone else was congregating, as we so often see in our Christmas nativity plays. Do you have any ideas about sort of when this particular aspect of the Christmas story is supposed to have occurred?
Well, I think that there's obviously a lot of debate about what precise dwelling Jesus is born in. The particular Greek word can be translated in a variety of ways. It's possible that it is in a part of a home which was normally reserved for animals, in which case it's possible that by the time the Magi arrive that they're maybe in the same structure but in a different part of the house, in the human dwelling part of the house. Again, it depends on how one translates the Greek in that first place. The part of the issue really is when the Magi arrive. It seems to me that the Magi are arriving, you know, within a couple of months of the birth, and so that's the kind of normal journey
time.
Okay,
I have heard other people suggest maybe Jesus was a toddler or something by the time the Magi arrived. Do you think it's probably earlier on, do you?
The reason that that's suggested by some people is because Herod slaughters the infants up to those in their second year, based upon when the star first appeared. But really, when Herod's asking that the assumption of the people that make that decision is that the language of appearing means the same thing as the language of rising. And in my book, among other things, I challenge that because it seems to me it's much more natural to interpret the language of appearing to be when the star first appeared,
okay,
and rising at a separate point in the star's career when it's emerging from a period of invisibility because of proximity to the sun, and it's first emerging back, becoming visible over the eastern horizon. And so certainly we know from ancient Babylonian records of comets, for example, that they took note of comets at particular points in a comet's time in the sky. One of those was when the star a comet first appeared, and another was when a star had a rising.
Mm.
And so I think the problem with assuming anyway that the appearing and the rising were the same thing is that it means that the Magi have for some bizarre reason really delayed their trip for some extraordinary amount of time, or somehow their trip has taken a long time. Whereas when one allows the first appearance to be separate from the rising, it's a much more natural development of time. So you're, because the Magi are quite clear in Matthew chapter 2, verse 2, when they come to Jerusalem, they say, "Where is he who's been born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star at its rising and have come to worship him." So it's what's happened in the eastern sky at the rising,
yeah,
which has prompted them to come to Jerusalem. So anyways, it's because of that, I would suggest that they're arriving quite soon after Jesus' birth.
I mean, we'll come to the subject of what exactly this star consisted of that Matthew writes about, of course, in his story. Of course, there are many skeptics out there, and I actually saw on the internet a billboard funded by an atheist group in America recently, which consisted of the three wise men sort of silhouetted against the typical sort of eastern sky with the star in the distance. And they had put on above it, "You know, it's just a myth, right?" kind of thing. So that there is this view out there that lovely story, but it's just a myth. OK, what convinces you, Colin, that this story is historically credible? This story that Matthew tells of these Magi traveling overland to follow a star to visit this infant baby.
Well, I mean, you're right to say a lot of people have, you know, rejected it, or certainly, and some have kind of ridiculed it, saying, you know, how can a star be in the east and then next thing it's in the south and the next thing it's in, and kind of making light of it. But the problem really is when you're looking at anything in any writing, one needs to look at it in light of its genre, and. You know, recent gospel scholarship has really been promoting and come to the conclusion that what we have in Matthew is an ancient biography. That is its genre, and that it has a concern for historical accuracy, just like many ancient contemporary biographers did when they were writing about subjects in the relatively recent past, such as Suetonius. So really, when one approaches Matthew or any of the Gospels with an awareness of that implicit claim, which comes with an awareness of the genre, then you really have to read it in a much more sympathetic way. So it's really illegitimate to just suddenly say, "Well, the star bit, well, that's just myth," or what have you. One has to say, "Well, Matthew's making a claim that this occurred." And then the question is, is it something that occurred? Is Matthew mistaken? Mm, is he right? And when we look at the actual account of the Magi and the star, it really is quite strongly, it's got the marks of historical reliability, really. You know, Matthew's account fits beautifully, actually, with what we know from Josephus about the latter years of Herod. Herod was particularly paranoid and really dead set on trying to establish his dynasty prior to dying. So we actually went through six or seven wills in an attempt to find a successor or successors to his reign. And so he was obsessed with that right at the time of Jesus' birth. In fact, he even oversaw the killing of three of his sons and one of his wives and arranged for one representative from each noble family to be killed in order to guarantee mourning when he himself died.
Yeah.
So it really, what Matthew says fits very, very nicely into that context. It's exactly what we would expect Herod to do in the kind of where he's at that point in time. As well as the fact, of course, no Jew or Christian, and certainly no Jewish Christian, is going to invent astrologers to be the heroes of this story. They're not credible witnesses, really, that would have a lot of weight normally in the circles that they're trying to influence. So that, and there's other points.
Yeah,
that,
so the criterion of embarrassment, as the historians call it sometimes, comes to bear in that sense. Well, before I bring in some other sort of questions on this, in case anyone else has a question, just tell us about the star itself then, because your theory is that it was actually a comet. I mean, I've heard other theories that it was the conjunction of a couple of planets that created this spectacle in the sky. It was Jupiter, it was a supernova. But you say, no, a comet is the most likely explanation. And I'm going to have to keep you brief, if at all possible, on this. But briefly, why do you think that's the best explanation for the star?
Well, in essence, the problem with all of those other theories that you mentioned is that they really don't fit very naturally with what Matthew explicitly states. Matthew says the star appears suddenly, remains visible for over a year, does something amazing in connection with the rising that seems to be very meaningful and communicates that the Messiah has been born. It's in the south to lead the Magi to Bethlehem, and then it's standing over the house. And when you just take that simple data from Matthew without trying to make some theory fit and just let Matthew's data come to the surface, then, you know, the supernova theory, well, it can't explain the movement of the star from the eastern morning sky to the southern evening sky within a short period of time. And of course, there's no remnants of supernova from 2,000 years ago. And we could go through each of the kind of theories analyzing and finding the problems. The thing about a comet is that a comet fits beautifully, really, with what we know of the Star of Bethlehem. We think of that first rising and lasting for a year. That's something which a great comet can do, like a comet like Hale-Bopp was visible to the naked eye for 18 months. We think of the Magi referring to a rising. It's evidently surprising to them and extraordinary to them. Well, that's something that most risings in astronomical terms are very kind of boring visual events, and they were predictable. But the rising of a comet, that's not predictable to the ancients, nor is it dull to look at. It can be very spectacular if a comet is making a close pass by the sun. Mm. So even the language of rising there is strongly suggestive, it seems to me, of a comet.
And when it talks about the idea of it, you know, guiding them to Bethlehem, I mean, standing over the stable even, what do you make of that kind of language?
Well, that very language is used by ancient historians of comets. Diodorus Siculus talks about a comet that went before Timoleon, that literally went before and led him to Sicily when he's heading to Sicily. Similarly, Josephus speaks about a comet that stood over Jerusalem prior to its destruction, heralding its demise. So this very language is used of comets in the ancient world. And it makes sense, really, for those who are in the ancient world who are looking to the stars or traveling and naturally view the stars as kind of accompanying them on their journey. Mm. That kind of way of thinking about the stars was very common up until recent time.
Well, look, we'll see what the others make of this as we continue today's program. We're already at the end of our first section, though, of today's Unbelievable. I told you it would fly by. We've got so many guests on the program today. So we conduct a Christmas special for Unbelievable, getting to the truth behind the Star of Bethlehem. And you've been hearing there Colin Nicol, author of The Great Christ Comet, telling us about his new theory, revealing the true star of Bethlehem. Nick Pandolfi, Phil Vischer and Ruth Jackson also join me on today's programme. Do come again in just a moment's time for the second part of today's show as we continue the discussion. And we'll be hearing from Nick why he celebrates Christmas and loves going to church at Christmas, even though he's not a believer.
May the Force be with you. And also with you. As the new Star Wars film blasts off, Premier Christianity magazine brings you the definitive Christian guide to the incredibly popular film series. Plus, we visit Bethel in Redding, California, and find out why many say heaven is coming on earth at Bill Johnson's Church for Continuous Revival, while others claim it's a dangerous deception. Also, discover what craftivism is, six things the Bible doesn't say about money, and much more. Sounds interesting? Request your free copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Well, Welcome back to the programme today. A Christmas special for you. I hope you're enjoying your Boxing Day. But whether you're listening here on Premier Christian Radio or via the podcast, I hope you've had a lovely Christmas. And we're kind of keeping the Christmas spirit going today on the programme here on Unbelievable, ditching our usual debate format for more of a roundtable discussion between a variety of guests. Joining me, Justin Brierley, on the show that aims to get you thinking. We've had a fascinating contribution already from Colin Nicol, author of The Great Christ Comet, and we'll return to talking about that and what our other guests on the show today make of his theory that, in fact, the Star of Bethlehem was, in fact, this comet rising in the east, as it were, to guide the Magi to the infant Jesus. Ruth Jackson is deputy editor of Premier Youth Work and Children's Work magazine. She joins me today to talk about Santa Claus. We're going to get into that. Phil Vischer is well known for creating the VeggieTales animated films and a number of other kids sort of apologetics and Bible series, and he's going to be talking a little bit as well about those kinds of issues. And Nick Pandolfi joins me too, radio presenter for The Beach, and he's going to be telling us, well, you might as well tell us it now, Nick, about the way that you tend to celebrate Christmas. So let me get this straight, Nick. You don't believe in the Christmas story, but you do like going to church for the carols and whatever at Christmas. So is this just because of the nostalgia value? What's going on with that, would you say?
I use and abuse, clearly. I use and abuse. It's convenient to me. I'd like to believe the Christmas story. Listening about the about Colin's book, I wish I'd ordered that for Christmas. My birthday's coming up in January, so there's a hint. But no, I should like to. And I was brought up by atheists, and but they encouraged me to discover a religion. They didn't hide it from me. We were showered with love. We weren't a wealthy family at all, but Christmas was a very important occasion in the house, and I played Joseph when I was four, and apparently I did a good job. And I to this day, I love Christmas, and I love the chattels associated with it. That's the food, the materialism, the happiness, and the celebration of family. And I guess the celebration of family is pretty key to all Christians, isn't it? So I suppose I'm not that far from many of you.
Well, what do you go along to sort of a carol service, though? Would you be caught in church sort of singing lustily to Hark the Herald Angels?
You can't beat a good opportunity if you're not a particularly great singer to go along to church in the run up to Christmas, and basically you can exercise your vocal cords, and you're forgiven for not sounding particularly great. Yes, if only church could be as good all year round as it appears to be at Christmas, I think they're onto a winner.
Right. I mean, in a sense, it's a great opportunity for someone who may never darken the door of the church the rest of the year to come inside. I mean, is there any sense, I don't know, I'm not accusing you of this, Nick, but of hypocrisy by singing the words of the Christmas story, but not really believing them?
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy with me celebrating Christmas. I should probably sit at home and
repent
repent and flick through pages of a Hawkins book, hitting myself on my head with it, saying this is all nonsense. This is all nonsense, and I'm grumpy, grumpy, grumpy. But do you know what? We were celebrating at this time of year, long before Christianity. So whether Christianity had occurred, whether we didn't have religion, I suspect that mankind would be having some sort of celebration at a key point in the year.
Phil, I'll bring you in at this point. Do you see people kind of turning up in church that you don't see the rest of the year in your neck of the woods at Christmas time?
Oh yeah. You've got Christmas and Easter Christians, and that's pretty common. And pastors always strategize. You know, there's a certain portion of my audience that I've only got twice a year. I better say something so stunning that they show up the next week too, which almost never happens. But it's a good try. I think more interesting what's going on in the U.S. is this the attachment to the celebration, simultaneous to the rejection of the doctrine. You know, so we love it. And that's why Christians get so cranky, because it's like, you want the trees, you want, you know, Starbucks, you want red cups, but you don't want to put anything on them, you know, and then we just get bent out of shape that everyone wants to celebrate. I mean, I just heard a new Christmas song on the radio yesterday while I was shopping, because when you're shopping, everyone plays nothing but Christmas music, because for some reason it makes you buy more. And the song they were playing was a brand new song, because if you can write a good Christmas song, you can make money for the rest of your life.
You're made for life. Yeah, absolutely.
but this one was, it was, you need a little holiday in your life.
Right.
So, and it was all, it was family and fun and friendship. And it was so just watered down to nothing that I just kept finding myself saying, which holiday in particular do I need more of? You know, Groundhog's Day, the 4th of July, pick a holiday. And so I find it interesting that we love to celebrate, but we don't want the doctrine anymore. Mm, so we're turning it into just kind of a general fuzzy feeling rather than actually, you know, celebrating something.
Yeah. Do you think that's the same situation here in the UK, Ruth, that Christmas has become, if you like, the general feeling of Christmas rather than any specific thing we're celebrating at Christmas?
Yeah, I think so. And I think particularly among a younger generation where it's not been so much a part of their culture. So the Evangelical Alliance did something recently. I think it said that 1 in 3 children have no idea where Christmas, you know, why Christmas.
Yes, which is worrying.
Why we celebrate Christmas. Yeah. So I think there is definitely a sense in which everyone celebrates Christmas, but no one's particularly sure why we do it.
Yeah, I guess... Is the church to blame? Have we dropped the ball here by allowing this situation to develop where so many young people don't know that Christmas is actually about the birth of Jesus Christ? Or is it just the inevitable tide of culture going in that direction?
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting that Nick says, I wish Christmas was like that. Oh, I wish church was like that the rest of the time. And I think there's something to be said for the fact that maybe, you know, us as Christians and churches are not doing a good job of kind of making church interesting. You know, I think there's a ton of people, probably my age, I'm 30, probably my age, who spent kind of their childhood in church and there just wasn't anything relevant for them. And therefore, they sort of made the assumption that actually if they went to church now, it still wouldn't be relevant.
Mm.
And there probably is something to say about, you know, there's probably something in that.
Yeah. When you go to church at Christmas, Nick, what do you get out of it? What's what is it about turning up? Is it kind of the nostalgia value, the feeling it gives you when you're singing the Christmas carols and whatnot?
I'm not painting a very good picture here. It's not great CV, but I've admitted to being a hypocrite. So I'll admit to selfishness now. It makes me feel good.
Yeah,
I go because I enjoy it, in the same reason that I go for chocolate bar A, because I prefer that one. And but it also, there is a connection. I quite enjoy watching the Queen's speech at 3:10. I'm never entirely sure what she's going on about, but I quite enjoy doing it because it connects me with generations past.
Right.
And I'm also conscious that, you know, whilst I joke and say, yes, I love the materialism, there is something bigger going on at Christmas other than are my lights going to last through until New Year on the tree?
Absolutely. I mean, do you feel like we should be trying to keep Christ in that sense at the centre of Christmas? Or are you quite happy for kind of that to eventually fade out in some way, Nick?
Well, no, of course not. No, it's been far too diluted. Who's to blame for that? I think the church has got something to do with that, probably. I think the problem with religion often is the church. But I think that, no, it'd be rather, what would be the point? What would be the point if there wasn't something beneath the veneer of tinsel and stuffing and bread sauce and everything, if there wasn't something there of purpose? Because, frankly, you might as well move Christmas to August bank holiday when the weather's better.
Yes, well, yeah, quite possibly. Anything to add to this, Colin? I mean, we're not here to round on Nick for his hypocrisy or anything.
But or selfishness.
Or selfishness, for that matter. I don't know, what do you think needs to happen to, I guess, help people to connect Christmas with what, you know, it has historically been connected with up till now, the birth of Christ? What can we do, Colin?
Yeah, I it's a good question, and I suppose part of my motive for writing the book and taking the time to do this is to inject a greater sense of reality into the Christmas traditions to enable readers to gain access to the story and to feel the power of the story, so that their experience of Christmas is much more meaningful, and really what for many people is sentimentality and tradition, but really comforting and wonderful, but can also have a kind of gripping and joyful and powerful dimension to it. So I mean, that's something I've sought to do, because it seems to me, as I've sought to do write the book, it's a way, an avenue into the experience of the Magi. And what I seek to do is to allow the reader to feel something of their awe, so that when they get to the house where the Messiah is, that the reader feels something of what they experienced, of their sense of joy and of the sense of the awe of what has transpired and who they're about to meet. So, but I think that is one of the beautiful things about even the Star of Bethlehem itself, is it is, in a way, it encapsulates the joy and the power and the wonder of Christmas and all of that, you know.
I wonder,
something interesting happened.
Go ahead, Phil.
Three years ago, with the Sandy Hook shootings in the States, where 22 kids were killed in an elementary school 11 days before Christmas, and what I thought was interesting is that some people in the community took down their Christmas decorations. As a result of the shooting, they said, we cannot celebrate Christmas right after such a tragedy. And I thought that was profoundly telling about the emptiness of the holiday now for most of the public. Because if you really understood Christmas, if you really understood what it means for God to become incarnate, to join us in our suffering, you know, when tragedy happens, that's when you would celebrate Christmas all the more. But because the church has failed to really explain that, we don't paint a compelling picture of the kingdom of God anymore and the point of Christmas, so that when something bad happens, people throw away their Christmas trees. When we should be doing the exact opposite. I found that really, really personally compelling.
It's a really interesting example, actually. I was going to ask you, Nick, whether I had a friend who once said, who was an atheist, and said, but when I listen to Bach, I am a Christian. I don't know whether you ever have that experience in church, when you do go to church. And do you ever have, if not a kind of a head connection, a heart connection with this story, with this thing that's being told, and the music and everything else? Or is it just kind of nice feelings but it's kind of, down to the pub straight after?
Well, be a Diet Coke because I'm teetotal, but so it's a cheap round. The only time that I have felt a connection with something, a powerful feeling, shall we call it, a connection, yes, maybe, with a name like Pandolfi, you may have guessed that I'm half Italian, so therefore I've spent a lot of time in Italy, and when I visited Rome on occasions, I have found myself being swept away by a feeling that I hadn't experienced before. Now, that could be the drama, the setting, the stage set, the wonderful scenery, the history of that particular spot, or it could be something else. I don't know. Hence, I'm on that agnostic fence.
Ruth, any advice to nudge Nick off the fence in terms of, I don't know, what do you say to people who are, they like church, they're not against church, and I don't get the feeling that Nick is particularly against church, but they're just not convinced at the end of the day, particularly with Christmas in mind, which often I think can unfortunately be spun as a bit of a fairy tale, a nice story, but as Colin was saying there, often people don't get a sense that this is a real historical thing and it matters, and here's why kind of thing. Any advice on that front?
Well, I think what Colin, the research that Colin's done, and similar research that's been done into other sort of aspects of Christianity, I think that's a really important part of why people should believe. So, Colin looking into the fact that it's potentially a comet and therefore it gives it real historical veracity to actually what happened, and therefore maybe it's not just a myth. And I think flip forward you know, 30 years or whatever, and there's the same sort of things around the resurrection, whether you believe it happened or not. There's quite a lot of kind of historical evidence pointing towards certain things. Mm. And I think actually, if you kind of look into those historical groundings for the certain for things that happen, you effectively do have to say, did it happen or didn't it happen? And if it did happen, you can't really just sit on the fence. So I think there's that kind of head thing, which is, you know, what people like C.S. Lewis, you know, he famously said that he was the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England, and you know, he almost didn't want to believe, but he was just compelled by the evidence. Mm. But then you've got that kind of heart compulsion. So for a lot of people, they come to faith in quite a dramatic way. It's a real, like, they're just absolutely overwhelmed. Maybe it's in a church service, maybe it's after, you know, a terrible bereavement or something like that, and something just utterly compels them. And I guess it's partly depends how you're wired, but I guess for Nick, he's obviously enjoys church, so there's the kind of heart element, but he's obviously a thinker as well, so he's obviously thought about these things. And I guess I would just say, keep on thinking, keep on going to church, and hopefully at some point
it will improve. Try it in the rest of the year. We now come to the really serious topic of the programme, Santa Claus, and I will reiterate the disclaimer I gave earlier. There are spoilers here for children who may still enjoy hearing about Santa Claus. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and press into this important topic. You've actually written a bit in the December edition of the magazine, I think, Ruth, of Children's Work, or was it Youth Work magazine, about Santa Claus and how we should deal with that with young people, because it does present a few question marks, I suppose.
Yeah.
We all love, in a way, well, most of us love the idea of Santa Claus bringing the presents, the kids, you know, wake up on Christmas morning, stockings are full and everything else. Does it pose problems a bit later on, though, once kids, you know, you're effectively having to lie, firstly, to your children? And is that OK? Is it OK to lie sometimes about these things? Does it set you up for possible problems later on? I've heard other Christians say this, who have said, and it sounds a bit Scrooge-ish, but I never encouraged my children to believe in Santa Claus because it was only going to set them up for thinking, well, what else did you lie to me about, i.e. this Christian lark, you know. So these are some of the common problems that maybe crop up for people when they're thinking about this. What's your take on it, Ruth?
I mean, I think it's really interesting. I think there is definitely the worry that if they lie to you about Santa, you know, maybe Jesus isn't real too. And I think that's one argument. I guess the other argument as well is that Santa's sort of theology, for want of a better word, is a total antithesis to the gospel, in that, you know, if you're good, you get on the good list. If you're naughty, you get on the naughty list.
Yeah.
And you get punished. Whereas actually the gospel's the flip reverse of that actually, no matter what you've done, God's love is big enough and he's calling you home and there's forgiveness. So I guess in that sense, it's a bit confusing, because are we instilling a kind of legalistic theology into our children? Mm. But I think with the Santa Claus thing, Richard Dawkins sort of famous. He said that we shouldn't be reading our children any fairy stories because, you know, we're setting them up for a fall by kind of telling them that a frog kissing a princess is a thing, and actually it's never going to happen. So we're just sort of setting them up for a fall. And I think he's got a good point. But at the same time, you know, we as humans, we're storytellers. We want to kind of evoke the imagination. And I think there's something about Santa that really brings out the heartwarmingness, that's definitely not a word, but of Christmas. And actually, yes. I was chatting to two little kids at church on Sunday, and they've both got severe learning difficulties, and they were having this just adorably cute kind of stilted conversation between them, asking each other if they believed in Santa. And the conclusion was that they did believe in Santa, and one of them then was telling me that Santa had written her a letter. So obviously I wanted to know what Santa had written her a letter about. So, and she had a test coming up that she was really worried about, and Santa had basically written just to encourage her and tell her what she was good at and just to remind her that actually she was going to be okay in the test. And I just thought that was a really heartwarming way. Of course her parents could have told her that she was going to be great in the test and encourage her, but I think there's something about Santa telling her that really kind of gets her excited. That's not to say that we should be doing it at the expense of truth, but I think there was something really heartwarming, particularly for that little girl. She, you know, she really needed that kind of
Phil, what's your policy when it comes to Santa Claus in your household?
Yeah, my wife is kind of anti-Santa. Mm-hmm. My upbringing was a little more Santa agnostic, okay. I think. You know, we didn't, my parents didn't really promote it, but they also didn't, you know, try to squash it when it came up. What I tried to do, because I did a Christmas special just a couple of years ago called Why Do We Call It Christmas? And I wanted to see if I could address the Santa issue in a way that conservative Christians wouldn't freak out about, you know, one way or another. Because okay. We've got people mad in our church if you say there is no Santa, and we've got others who are mad if you say there is. And so what we did was simply say to kids, okay, what's Santa's other name? What's his real name? You know, up on the rooftops, click, 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 down through the chimney comes.
Saint
and
Nick.
The kids get it immediately because okay. They've learned those yeah. songs in school, yeah. Old Saint Nick. And we said, okay, who's Saint Nicholas? And then we unpack the historical Saint Nicholas and say Santa Claus and even explain how did the name Saint Nicholas turn into the name Santa Claus, you know, due to Dutch immigrants coming to the U.S. who were saying Saint Nicholas.
Oh, there you go. You learned something new. I didn't know that. But,
yeah, so it's the history. I mean, Santa Claus is basically an American creation that we've now exported to the rest of the world along with Coca-Cola and hamburgers. Thank you very much.
I think actually Father Christmas was exported to the U.S. and you rebranded him.
Yeah, maybe, like maybe not, though, because the Dutch were here before Father Christmas was here, and the Dutch were celebrating St. Nicholas, but doing it in Dutch, which confused us.
Yeah.
Father Christmas was a rejection of Catholicism in the UK so that they could still celebrate St. Nicholas and the traditions of St. Nicholas without actually being Catholic anymore.
Wow.
So there. Anyway, so with kids, what we try to say is, look, who's Santa Claus? Santa Claus is St. Nicholas. Who is St. Nicholas? St. Nicholas was a guy who loved Jesus so much that he went out of his way to give gifts to people who were in need, to show them the love of Jesus. That's who Santa Claus is. And when you connect it with something that is both historically true and theologically true, you can actually get excited about celebrating Santa Claus.
I think that's quite a fruitful way of trying to sort it out. I mean, Nick, I'll let you continue there. What do you do with the Santa Claus thing?
Father Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Father Christmas in our house and quite a few others, I believe. But yeah, Father Christmas is...
you don't like this terminology, Santa Claus, I can tell.
The English language has been given to the world and some people have been very naughty with it. But anyway, that aside, another discussion. Father Christmas, no. I can't help but feel that some within the church, some religious folk are rather annoyed that this incredible Christmas story with all this incredible PR has been slightly hijacked by this rather rotund gentleman in a red suit. And he's getting all the good press.
Yes.
And the church gets beaten up about all the negativity. And actually, this bloke going around in a sleigh with Rudolph and a few others is getting all the good news.
It's true.
Of course, it feeds the imagination. What a dull society we would be if we never told a story. If we don't feed an imagination, you'd never have any fun. And frankly, parents lie to you all the time. Auntie Hilda's chin with the hairs on won't hurt when you kiss her. She doesn't have bad breath. You will like it at school tomorrow. Parents have to lie to children all the time. It's part of growing up.
There you go. What about you, Colin? Because you've already told us how your Christmases tend to be very biblically centered, and I of all of our guests, I just have a feeling you might have the most problem possibly with Father Christmas or Santa Claus, depending on which you're going with. What do you do in your household?
Well, it's real to me. It's very much a kind of conscience issue of what someone wants to do with it. I mean, my wife kind of came from her background. Santa wasn't a really big deal. When I grew up, you know, Santa was a major part of it and a major part of the excitement of it. When we got married and had kids, then we kind of decided, well, what are we going to do? And then we made the kind of what seemed for us in the terms of our backgrounds that we weren't going to do the Santa thing. The funny thing is, even when you don't do the Santa thing, the kids almost kind of, everyone else is doing the Santa thing. So they kind of enjoy Santa, even though they don't really believe in it. I asked my kids last night, actually, you know, what do you regret? They're a little bit, you know, 10 years and 8 years old. Did you ever regret not being told about Santa? And they said, no, we actually enjoy Christmas better And we get we enjoy the more kind of personal aspect that when we get gifts, that the gifts are from you guys, and you know they love Christmas, and I think they like Christmas better than even their friends like Christmas. So I don't know. To me, the Santa thing, I enjoyed it growing up. I don't have a huge problem with it, but to me, it is a somewhat of a distraction from having a meaningful Christmas, because Santa has become so huge in our society, and it really basically does. It's really become almost a Santa Claus Christmas.
He is a bit, the, as Nick described there, the competitor for the story of Christmas from Jesus in some ways. But then at the same time, you know, we were hearing about C.S. Lewis earlier from Ruth, but it's interesting to note, isn't it, that in the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Father Christmas comes along. Lewis wasn't afraid to insert that character in his, you know, seminal story about that is, if you like, an allegory of the story of Christ and the cross and everything else. And he was happy to kind of introduce Father Christmas. So I don't know. What do you make of that? Is that something that hey, if it's kind of got overtones, if it's got something that's helpful, use it. But if not, don't.
Well, I think it really depends. I mean, as each individual family looks at it and goes, what are the pros and cons of taking that approach? Is it, you know, how much does it add to the excitement? Of course, you've got the disappointment. You know, I know a family where the child was just devastated when he discovered the reality. And really, you know, it really, the devastation was such that almost overwhelmed and destroyed all of the joy that came
really?
Before.
Oh, that's yeah, really sad. That's really sad.
It is. So it's a kind of funny thing. I suppose it depends. Again, I think it can be a good thing, and I'm not opposed to, you know, the role of myth in the home, and I think that can have a function. And we also take the approach of explaining the background of St. Nicholas and going into some of the stories and the history of that to kind of add to it. So it's not like the kids wouldn't recognize Santa, obviously, or appreciate it. And if there's ever a photo opportunity with a Santa, they will be the first in line, and they'll be the ones with the biggest smiles on it. So it's a little bit funny in it, you know.
Great stuff. We're just coming towards the end of this second part of the programme, and we're just going to have time to wrap up with my guests who have joined me for this special Christmas edition of Unbelievable this Boxing Day here on Premier Christian Radio. Don't forget, you can listen to Unbelievable online as well, and get hold of a vast back catalogue of programmes too. If you want to see how we've tackled Christmas on the show in debate form over the years, then why not search back in the catalogue and you'll find that there. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable for all your unbelievable needs. And we'll be back in a short moment's time as we conclude our conversation. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable. It's a Boxing Day Christmas special, and a lot of interesting special guests joining me for today's programme. We'll be back with them in a moment's time. Coming up later on today on Premier Christian Radio, you can hear loads more carols and Christmas services. Between 4 and 5, there's A Christmas from Swansea, an uplifting service from Mount Pleasant Baptist Church in Swansea. Between 5 and 6, the traditional carol service from Methodist Central Hall Westminster, A Classical Christmas at 6 with Michael Fanstone. And loads more going on through to the evening, when you can hear carols from Shropshire, Christmas Unsigned and International Christmas, and much more besides. Do go and check the schedule if you're not sure and you want to find out more. PremierChristianRadio.com, and it's all available there. Next week here on Unbelievable, it'll be the new year, and to see in the new year, I've got a fantastic debate for you. Perry Marshall joins me. He's the author of the book Evolution 2.0, which claims to forge a new path between evolution and intelligent design. And he's going to be debating atheist biologist P.Z. Myers on whether Darwinian evolution can account for what happens in the cell. Well, that'll be a cracking discussion next week at the same time. And of course, you can find it online as well as today's show. So if you want more, you want to download the podcast, get the past articles and the blog and all the kinds of other things, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable is the place to go. Later on today's show, we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme, and I'm going to squeeze in time for an extra guest, David Suchet. He's the TV and film actor best known for portraying Agatha Christie's Detective Poirot on our TV screens. And I caught up with him recently about a major Bible project he's been involved in and how he spends his Christmas, particularly as he was an adult convert to Christianity. So look out for that. David Suchet, my conversation with him coming up a little bit later later on. Right now, let's finish our discussion on all things unbelievably Christmas related. Well, today on the programme, it's been great to be joined in something of a different format to the usual format of Unbelievable by four guests. Colin Nicol, author of The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem. Ruth Jackson, deputy editor of Premier Youth Work and Children's Work magazines and heading up Premier's Youth Apologetics too. Phil Vischer, creator of Veggie Tales and What's in the Bible, Buck Denver and more. And Nick Pandolfi, who's been our radio skeptic, coming on the line for us from where he works at the Beach radio station. I thought it would be fun, because there's so many of us, and I wanted to find a way of signing off this part of the programme. If we all shared a memory of Christmas, we've done the discussion on Santa Claus, Father Christmas, I should say, for Nick's sake, and indeed church going and the Star of Bethlehem as well. But often it's, you know, the feeling that Christmas evokes that often stays with us a long time. My one is when I was younger, my dad managed to nearly set the kitchen on fire one Christmas. In our family, as in many, there's a tradition of lighting the Christmas pudding. I don't know, come to think of it, Phil, as a native in the USA, do you have Christmas pudding?
No, we do not have Christmas pudding. It didn't make it over here.
So for those who are listening by podcast also in the States and not sure what the Christmas pudding thing is, so it's basically like a rich fruit pudding. And the tradition is that it's sort of soaked in some kind of alcohol, brandy or whatever. And you light it with a match and it sort of it's in flames. They go out after a little while and then you can all sit down and eat the pudding. In our case, it was lit in the kitchen and some napkins nearby caught fire, which then set some handles of some knives and forks on fire, which we didn't know were obviously some kind of flammable plastic. And before long, there was smoke billowing in the kitchen. My dad was kind of basically flapping at it with a tea towel before my younger sister had the presence of mind to go in, pull down the kitchen sort of fire blanket and put it over the whole thing. So she saved Christmas for us basically that year. But that is my abiding memory of one Christmas that nearly went horribly wrong, but fortunately didn't in the end. Ruth, any memories to share of Christmases gone by?
I think probably my sort of most vivid memory, I mean, I was five, so it can't have been that vivid, but my little sister, as I alluded to earlier in the programme, was born on the 23rd of December, and she came out of the hospital with my mum on Christmas Day. So me and my twin got our own little plaything for Christmas, which was fun. And I guess it kind of brought to life the idea of Jesus being born as a baby and just quite how vulnerable he would have been as a little person.
Absolutely, yeah. I was born on Christmas Eve myself, so
I
am a Christmas baby. Indeed. What about you, Colin? Any Christmas memory that you'd like to relate to us?
Well, thinking about it, when I was in primary school and we did a little nativity play, I was always the donkey. And I loved being the donkey. I was a very naughty donkey.
Were you?
And so I really thrived in the role. And year after year, they would give me the role of the donkey, and I would always try to be somehow the donkey would end up being center stage. and the donkey would sometimes go naughtily, speedily with Mary and Joseph and what have you. So, but then this one year, when I was in what we call primary seven, the whole class conspired to appoint me Joseph. And I did not want to be Joseph because Joseph had to hold Mary's hand.
Yeah.
And at that age, I did
How
not want to.
Embarrassing. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the teacher had great enjoyment from appointing me Joseph and seeing my utter embarrassment and humiliation.
Did someone else say they played Joseph as well in the school nativity?
Yeah, that was me.
That was you, Nick. Because I've played Joseph as well, and I'm just wondering whether, Phil, have you ever played Joseph in the school nativity?
I have never once played Joseph.
You're not in the Joseph Club. I'm sorry
much too,
about
much
that.
Too shy.
I once fell off the stage when I was Angel Gabriel. I fell straight off the stage. Sort of mid-song, you know, ushering in and everything to the shepherds. I literally fell straight off the back of the stage. I'm pretty sure no one noticed, which is a bit embarrassing.
I've got a story, actually, now you mention it, Colin, about being Joseph, which was when I did it probably the tender age of 7 or 8. Mary was, we had a real live donkey for ours.
Wow.
But Mary was too scared to ride the donkey. So Joseph rode into Bethlehem on the donkey that Christmas.
Chivalrous.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't understand why all the parents were laughing so much when that happened, but it's only latterly you come to realise. Nick, what did you want to share as a memorable Christmas moment?
Well, I would say, if I turn the soppiness right up, I would say it's the memory of happiness. And I suppose that's what drives me with my love of Christmas to this day with children and family as well, is that I just remember the feeling of just being so happy and waking up and everything around the house smelt different. It wasn't just the food, it was, this is completely different to any other time of the year. And it wasn't just about, was I going to get Lego or not? it was that feeling of that recognition of being loved. And you know, as you grow up, you realize that you share that with others through your life if you're lucky enough. And I think that's where my love of Christmas comes. It's just I was so lucky, so blessed as a child to have such wonderful Christmases that I've ensured that I try and continue that family tradition.
Lovely. That is a lovely memory to have from Christmas. And Phil, any Christmas memories that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think actually it's one that happens every year, which is when we decorate our tree. And the reason it's always interesting is because we're pulling out 25 years worth of ornaments. From every part of our lives and from every part of our kids' lives. You know, when they were in school every year, they made an ornament and we put the year on it, and some of them have their pictures on it. So my daughter, who is 18 now, my youngest, has had a really rough year, as teenagers sometimes have. But she was really looking forward to decorating the tree, and it was just so meaningful to be able to pull out, you know, our whole lives in ornaments and put them up, you know, and just have that, the history of your whole life reflected in tiny little pieces of plastic and, you know, and little things that your kids brought home from elementary school when they were 5 and 6 that they made out of clay, and putting those all on the tree. And it's like a history, a museum of your whole life.
It that is lovely. That is a really lovely way to build the memories in
quite
over the years.
Quite a full tree, I
yes,
imagine.
It is a very full tree. My wife thinks it looks ridiculous.
This is a common source of disagreement between spouses, in our family anyway. I always insist on A, a real tree, and B, a big one as well. And that's inherited from my dad, who always insisted on the same two, though it's not the most convenient thing very often to do. In any case, thank you very much all for being on the programme today. It's been great fun being able to share some of these memories and also some of the stories and the stuff that you've shared. Colin, the book's available, of course, for anyone who wants it, The Great Christ Comet, Revealing the True Star of Bethlehem. So I'll make sure there's a link to that from today's programme as well online. I do hope that you get lots of people interested in this, not just this Christmas, but in Christmases to come, because it's a fantastic resource you've given us there. So thanks for being with us, Colin.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Great to have you on. Ruth, thanks for being with us as well. If people want to find out more about children's work, excuse the bumping, someone's dumping something very large just outside the studio, if that was coming through on the microphone. Where can they find out more about the magazines that you're responsible for?
So if they go on the Premier Youth Work or Premier Children's Work websites, they can find that just from the main Premier website as well. We've got myself and Jamie, the editor, have done some a little video about Christmas, so it might be worth checking those out.
Yeah, great stuff. That's all available at premier.org.uk. Find your way to the magazines. PhilVischer.com, is that where people should go to check out your stuff?
That's correct.
Great stuff. All right, well, do that and download the podcast as well. I listen religiously every week to Phil. I know he does the same for me, or at least says he does.
It is mutual.
I must say, though, I do find it's great fun as well, Phil. So do check that out as well. And Nick, thank you very much for being with us on the programme today. And people can find you on Twitter and I'm sure in other guises online as well, can't they?
And trying not to make too much of a noise in a church at a carol service. Yes.
All right. Well, all the very best. Thank you for being with me on the programme today, folks, and a very happy Christmas to everyone.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it was a great pleasure to also be able to catch up with David Suchet recently. He's the TV and film actor best known for portraying Agatha Christie's Poirot. And I spent some short time with him at a restaurant near his home talking about his new Bible project and also how he spends Christmas. Here's our conversation.
David, thank you very much for joining me briefly.
You're welcome. It's nice to be with you.
It's been a busy year for you, but it's also been a busy few years recording and distributing the NIV Audio Bible. This was a massive undertaking, wasn't it? Exactly how many hours went into reading and recording the entire Bible?
Well, I'm told that it was about, just by the recording studio, I was in front of the microphone for about 250 hours.
Wow.
But in my study at home, there is probably another 300 hours to 400 hours preparation.
Now, I know it's available online via the app, via the CDs and so on.
Yes.
But when it came to you going through that and preparing to read all of that, it must have had an extraordinary impact on your understanding and engagement with the Bible yourself.
Well, the extraordinary thing was when I was recording the Bible, I was recording it with headphones on.
Right.
So, in a sense, I was doing what I wanted my listening audience to do, was to hear the Word of God, not just read the Word of God. And hear the Word of the Lord is in the Bible. It wasn't read the Word of the Lord, because most of the people were illiterate anyway.
It's a relatively modern idea, reading it for yourself. It was always spoken before.
It was always spoken. Yeah, and when the Jews came out of exile, and I think it's in Ezra, and they read the Bible day after day after day after day, and so the reader could be seen, and people were explaining it, and people were wailing and crying and everything. This is because they were listening. In other words, they were listening, taking it in. To listen is an active thing you do. It's not passive. You just don't sit. The greatest compliment you could give to anybody is giving them good ear. As Brutus says, lend me your ears.
Indeed.
He doesn't say just listen to me. He says give them to me for a while. So I had the great awareness of I was actually hearing the word of the Lord as I was speaking it. So that was an extraordinary experience.
Well, I'm looking forward to being able to listen to that. But your own journey, Christian journey, began as an adult, really. It was really an adult conversion that you had to Christianity. What did that mean for you when it came to the first Christmas you had, as it were, as a believer, as someone who suddenly realised what this Christmas thing was all about?
Yes, well, I have to say that coming to Christianity in middle age, at the age of 40, and realizing that you're a baby, it's a new birth, it takes a long time as a middle-aged man of 40 to accept that you're going to go through teething problems and learning how to walk and keeping falling over and getting bruised. And it's a difficult journey.
A humbling one.
It's a very humbling one, and especially at a particular stage in my life.
Yes.
So my early Christmases were with my family. My family was all... My son and daughter were already born.
Yes.
They'd already had Christmases with their secular father. And I suppose there was me wanting to drag them off to church as a young convert would. But no, what I did do was that I did read bits to them.
Right.
And I had to take it very gently with them, because the last thing I ever wanted to do was to hit anybody over the head with my own conversion. So the early Christmases I was made for myself, more aware of materialism and the secular world in which we live, and the secular world in which my children were growing up. And it was difficult.
I can imagine, even as in your secular phase, you'd been to carol services and that kind of thing, as people often do at this time of year. Did that come alive in a new way, though, the words of those traditional well-known carols and so on?
Yes, and also the traditional Christmas hymns and Wesley and all, you know, reading those words. I was reminded over and over again of how old our faith is. And we go back and back and back. We forget our roots sometimes.
Yes.
And we only think of Christianity in our own lifetime. And we forget the hundreds and thousands and millions of martyrs.
Yeah.
We forget Tyndale, who died to get the Bible written in English. Really? Yes. We forget the suffragettes.
Yeah.
We get young girls now not wanting to vote.
Yeah.
And we forget that women died for the vote.
Absolutely.
That people died for our Bible in English. Mm. And we just sort of ignore it.
Yeah.
And
we
it's such a shame.
Granted.
We take it for granted. It's, I've often said it's a sad thing that the book has been described as the biggest selling, most unread book in the world. And it's sad. And I hope that by reading the Bible out loud, it will reach the ears of Christians and non-Christians. It's not for any particular person. And it's not just for Christmas. But I would love to think at Christmas, and this is, I suppose, my message to you who are listening, listen to the Annunciation and birth of our dear Lord Jesus, because it was possibly the biggest mega moment in the whole of human history.
David Suchet there, the TV and film actor best known for portraying Agatha Christie's Detective Poirot. I wonder what you made of that, or indeed anything you heard on today's programme. Be interested to hear your response. You can always email, as ever, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And you can leave your feedback also via Twitter, via Facebook, and underneath the latest edition of the programme. At UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page of the programme. All those links and more, and the ability to leave a comment underneath the most recent programmes at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, just in the final minutes of today's programme, time to read out some of your feedback. And I think what I'll do this week, I never got around in recent editions of the programme to reading out some of the response that there was to David Robertson versus Michael Nugent. So they were debating whether Christianity has been a good thing for Northern Ireland or whether it's holding it back. That was a podcast-only special that I put out on the podcast feed of the programme. Quite a few people got in touch about that. Let's go for some of these from Kevin. Said, thanks for the Irish debate. David's opening remarks on the positive impact of Christianity in society were brilliant, but his eloquence broke down soon after that. Although his points were solid, his combative and dismissive manner with the audience and questioners seemed unchristlike. I don't mind if someone gets angry, Jesus sure did, but they shouldn't get argumentative and overly sarcastic. He did not have peace, and I think in the end he lost the debate due to his jabs and cynical dismissal of common and simple questions that still seemed to be sincere. Anyway, there you go. That was one view. Stephen Portlock says, as an admirer of the late Marcus Borg and a Vipassana meditation practitioner, I will probably not be recognised by David Robertson as a natural ally. But the debate on Christianity in Northern Ireland got me increasingly exasperated as it went along and inevitably led to David rising in my estimation. What was meant to be an intelligent debate increasingly degenerated into a one-sided exercise in haranguing Robertson. I have hard questions to ask of David, but I'm not interested in asking them now. I wonder, though, whether or not Michael Nugent thinks that the world would be better without religion. If so, then how can he also maintain that he's not opposed to its continued existence? He would presumably not seek also to preserve the existence of terrorism or rape. The notion that a state could freely allow religious people to observe their own practices, provided they don't in any way seek to influence social policy, reminds me of the worst excesses of communism and would, as David pointed out, be a direct route, to my mind, a figurative rather than literal hell. And Stephen, you end your email saying, given the tone of the debate, it seems fair to ask this slightly crude question of Nugent. As a physically disabled man living in a working class community in central London, who can I count on to save my ass, the atheist or the Christian? My smart money is on the latter. This is from Jeremy, who says, while listening to David Robertson versus Michael Nugent, I was distraught by the way David hurled several insults at David and audience members. Specifically, I noted a few cases where David was uncharitable during the debate, and you give the examples where you thought that he was, and you say many of David's comments were simply unnecessary to make, and as one audience member pointed out, David's demeanour throughout the debate was not one that displayed love and grace. As a Christian, it was hard for me to hear David engage in the debate the way he did. He made several good points during the debate, but they were overshadowed by his tendency to insult. Listening to this debate helped me in realizing more that as a Christian, engaging other people in conversation with gentleness and respect is more important than having the right arguments. I would like to apply that concept in my own discussions with people who have an opposing view. And this from Sam said he felt that neither David or Michael Nugent covered themselves in glory. They both came off badly, you say. And while David Robinson had been good on the show in the past, he seemed to get rattled and said many things rashly. I'm sure he'd love to do differently in hindsight. Michael seemed to take a page out of Hitchens' book and violate every rule of debate imaginable. Despite at the start of the show saying he hoped for a positive and open discussion, he went on to speak over his time, constantly interrupted David during his discourse, and used every question given to extend his own speeches and stoop to constant beration without attempting to understand David's clarification. A point on the debate in general seemed to be more a public attack of Christianity than a debate. No Christians from the audience asked questions. Everyone seemed to be an atheist or humanist, and even the moderator was insulting to David Robertson. The questions allowed were often insults or patronising of Christianity rather than questions seeking an answer. The whole thing seemed an unfair trial on a false playing field. Everything Michael said was applauded, and it seemed the entire crowd were atheists. David was also targeted from the start for not being Irish, as if that was his fault. Anyway, thank you very much. You were obviously different reactions to that debate, and it was a feisty one. This was before a live audience. It took place in Northern Ireland, and I think David has himself also blogged on his response to the debate. I believe he felt that there was very much a preponderance of, antipathy towards him from the audience, that he felt that it was a largely an atheist audience that actually turned up on the night. But in any case, you can go to his blog and read that there. I did get this interesting little thing, though, come via Facebook, which gave me pause for thought, because I knew that show was going to get that kind of response, because David certainly didn't pull his punches when it came to the interaction he had. But this from Dustin in Delaware in the US wrote in recently to the show saying, I'm writing to thank you for all your hard work. The platform you provide has had an enormous effect on me. I'm still unsure as to where I fall with regard to the inerrant truth of the Bible, but I will admit when I began listening a year ago to your show, I was firmly a non-Christian agnostic. But you, David Robertson, and William Lane Craig have forced me to move. I'm now a Christian, though I still have several points of contention and doubt. I listen to Unbelievable every day, poring through old episodes and trying to find someone who will attempt to answer my concern or question. Thanks so much for everything you've done. Since I have your ear, I have to say David Robertson's aggressiveness broke through my normal analysis of the debate and confronted me directly. I know people say they don't like his tone, and I see where they're coming from, but it was that tone, that confrontation, that made me angry, and when I went to put together an argument for why he was wrong, I came up short. Just to balance the scales against his detractors, says Dustin. So there you go. Lovely to hear from you, Dustin. And that really topped off my year, hearing that you had come to faith in the course of listening to the programme. I'm glad that whether it was myself, David, William Lane Craig, or whoever else was influential in helping you to overcome whatever scepticism and doubts you had, that's really good news. So great to hear from you. And if you'd like to get in touch with the show yourself, you can do that via Facebook, as Dustin did, or you can do it in other ways as well. There's the Twitter account, there's email, and all sorts more. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk. It's been lovely spending Boxing Day with you this Saturday afternoon, and I hope you'll continue to listen to Premier throughout the rest of the Christmas season. But if you're coming back next week for Unbelievable, let me remind you what's coming up then. You're unbelievable. Well, we're starting off the new year with a cracking debate on intelligent design, evolution, and, well, a new theory, really. This is from Perry Marshall, and his new book, Evolution 2.0, asks whether it's time to upgrade our view of what evolution is all about. He'll be debating atheist biologist P.Z. Myers on next week's programme. Hope you can come back for that at the same time and online. Coming up next, Christmas from Swansea.